So welcome everyone to our first preparation session for the Pardes Germany close-up trip. That's coming up in a couple of weeks. Today we're going to be talking about the origins of German or Ashkenazic Jewry. And we'll first talk about the term Ashkenaz. Anybody know where the term Ashkenaz comes from?
A name of part of Europe.
Well, outside of rabbinic literature and Jews in general, I don't know whether it's really used. Yeah, go ahead. Yes, there's somebody in Tanakh who is, it's Noah, it's actually Noach's great-grandson. If you look at Bereishit, the 10th parak, the 10th chapter, where it describes the lineages, Noach has a son named Yefet, and Yefet has a son named Gomer, and Gomer has a son named Ashkenaz. Okay, this also appears in Chronicles 1, chapter 1. So Ashkenaz is a great-grandson of Noach. It's unclear why the rabbis later used it to describe what the Romans called Gaul, G-A-U-L, right, the Franco-German areas. But that is the term that the rabbis assigned to it for whatever reason. Jews of Ashkenazic origin make up the large majority of the world Jewish population today. In fact, in 1939, 90% of world Jewry was Ashkenazic. Due to the Holocaust, obviously, that number has decreased, but still a large majority of world Jewry are Ashkenazim, meaning they descend from the Jews of the Franco-German area that the Romans called Gaul. Most historians believe that Jews migrated from Roman Italy northward into Gaul, perhaps even as traders who were supplying the Roman armies. In ancient times, armies didn't have their own supply system. Rather, soldiers had to buy food. We have a document from the year 321 that refers to Jews living in Cologne along the Rhine River. We even have a 4th century Jewish cemetery that was discovered in Cologne in the 1930s as well. So this is a very ancient Jewish community, and the document we have from 321 refers to them as a large and well-organized community. They were relatively free. They enjoyed the same legal status as Jews did in most of the Roman Empire, namely, they could practice any profession, including agriculture and owning land, but they could not missionize, they could not have Christian slaves, and they could not hold public office. Despite church efforts, the early Germanic kingdoms under the Franks and the Burgundians and Merovingians did not change the status quo of the Jews significantly. Charlemagne, for example, around the year 800, employed Jews for diplomatic purposes. His successor, Louis the Pious, forced Jews to pay special taxes to the king above and beyond what their Christian neighbors were paying. It was around this time that the church forbade Christians from lending money to other Christians and charging interest, which meant that Jews could engage in money lending in these areas. This, of course, was a double-edged sword. On the one hand, Jews were needed and Jews could profit. On the other hand, they were deeply resented. In terms of Jewish learning, the most significant figure in this early period is Rabbeinu Gershom Meor HaGola, the light of the exile. Rabbeinu Gershom lived around the year 1000. He establishes a yeshiva in Mainz, and I'm handing out a map. Sorry to those of you listening to this on tape, but I'm handing out a map of contemporary Germany that shows where the Rhine River is. It doesn't have the city of Mainz, but I'll be able to, you'll see an approximation of where it is. If you look at, it's in western Germany today. You see, from Dusseldorf to Cologne to Bonn, right, you could see the Rhine River and the Rhine Valley on the map, and it goes all the way to Heidelberg, okay? That Rhine River Valley was the center of Jewish life in this early period. In particular, there were three cities along the Rhine River that were the largest Jewish centers and the centers of Jewish learning at this time. Speyer in Hebrew. Worms or Vermeisa in Hebrew. And Mainz, which is Magenza in Hebrew. In fact, there's even a Hebrew acronym for these three cities, Shum, as in the word for garlic, but as an acronym, Speyer, Vermeisa, and Mainz. And in rabbinic literature, you'll find this expression of Shum time and again, because these were the three main cities. And as you could see from the map, Berlin is all the way in the eastern part of Germany today. And the Rhine River Valley, where Worms and Heidelberg are, where we'll be traveling, is all the way in the west. We're going to be taking, I think it's a 4 or 5 hour train ride in order to get there. And once again, I'm very appreciative to the Germany Close-Up people for indulging us in doing that, because I felt we could not go on a Jewish heritage trip to Germany without visiting those areas. According to some historians, in this period, around the year 1000, Mainz was the capital of European Jewry. It had its own yeshiva, the yeshiva of Rabbeinu Gershom, which was the only yeshiva in Central Europe at the time, Central or Eastern Europe at the time. And this marks the beginning of the moving away from dependence on the Geonim, who are in Bavel or Iraq, Mesopotamia, Tigris, Euphrates rivers. The heads of the yeshivot, the heads of the academies there, were without a doubt the leaders in Jewish learning and Jewish religious life in the world. They sent their responsa. They were asked questions from all over the world. They sent their responsa, their answers, all over the world. But by the year 1000, there are other Jewish communities that are starting to establish their own yeshivot, become their own centers of learning, and are becoming independent of the Geonim and of the Jewish communities in Iraq, today's Iraq. And clearly, the yeshiva in Mainz is one of the steps along that path. Rashi is a student of the students of Rabbeinu Gershom, just to put it in perspective. So in learning, he's a quote-unquote grandson of Rabbeinu Gershom. And we'll talk much more about Rashi when we go to his house. We'll learn more about him, and we'll learn Rashi when we get there. It's estimated that there were 6,000 Jews living in Mainz around the time of Rabbeinu Gershom and later Rashi, which would make it one of the largest Jewish communities in Europe, to be sure. 6,000 was a very large Jewish community at the time. Of course, population numbers were much, much smaller in those days. 1096 is a very important turning point in European history, a very important turning point in Jewish history, the First Crusade. And the First Crusade marks a tremendous increase in religious consciousness and I would say religious extremism in Christian Europe, which works to the detriment of the Jewish communities, particularly those along the Rhine River. These three Shum communities in particular came under attack. The Jewish community of Speyer was saved by the local bishop. But in Worms, which we'll be visiting, 800 Jews were murdered. And in all of the cities along the Rhine, one of the estimates is that as many as 12,000 Jews were murdered by the Crusaders of the First Crusade in May, June, and July 1096. Those of you who are familiar with the prayer that we say on Shabbat, right before Musaf, right before we put the Torah away, the Av HaRachamim prayer dates from this time period, which talks about the destruction of Jewish communities. And it was written as a response to the destruction of the Jewish communities along the Rhine River in 1096. The Crusaders who were going to liberate Jerusalem from the infidel, from the Muslims, for Christianity, said, why should we travel so far while the infidel is living amongst us? For that reason, what some people call the first Khorban, the first destruction of European Jewry, takes place in 1096. But the First Crusade has a great influence beyond just the events of 1096 for the Jews of Germany, because it's after 1096 that we enter a new era of heightened anti-Semitism in Germany, in Ashkenaz. And we see this, for example, with charges of ritual murder and desecrating the host. Ritual murder, I assume everybody is familiar with. What's ritual murder?
When they claim that we use their children and others, we're killing Christians to use an arm.
Right. So the blood libel or ritual murder accuses the Jews of murdering an innocent Christian child as a kind of a reenactment of the crucifixion of Jesus, which, of course, for the Christians is a very, very important part of their religion and history. And projecting out, they imagine it must be important to us as well. Some of the versions of this that are that the Jews stab the child 39 times, and then they take the blood and use it in the baking of matzot or for black magical purposes. Many of these charges occurred around the time of Easter when the crucifixion took place, according to the New Testament. Yes, Naomi?
Is there any idea about how such an idea of that started? Like, what kind of cultural
communication?
Or like, if it's just like...
Look, we don't have any evidence that Jews actually committed ritual murder. Although one Israeli historian recently has taken the position that, you know, we can't be 100% sure it never happened. But certainly we know that wasn't the norm of Jewish practice. Similarly, the charge of desecrating the host, which also is, again, a case of projection and connected to the crucifixion. Anybody know what desecrating the host is? Yeah, David? Yeah, the host is the wafer used in the Mass, in the Catholic Mass, it's meant to represent the body of Jesus, just as the wine represents the blood of Jesus. And in Catholic theology, there is the concept of transubstantiation, which holds that when you drink from the wine and when you eat from the wafer, that you are literally taking in, it somehow magically becomes the blood and the body of Jesus. It's not only a symbol, it actually becomes the body and blood of Jesus. For some reason, apparently, this wafer, which very well might have its origins in the matzah that we use on Pesach, can under certain circumstances develop some kind of orangish mold. Of course, seeing it, if you actually believe that it's the body of Jesus, someone put two and two together and got three and said, well, this must be Jesus bleeding. Now, who would want to make Jesus bleed? Only those people who want him dead. Who would want him dead? The Jews.
It's definitely, I read about this, but it's doubly irrational, actually, because even those people who believe that it is the body, it doesn't become the body.
Until it's imbibed.
Yes. If you do it before it
right.
The process,
David is saying that it's doubly fictitious only because it doesn't actually become the body of Jesus until the service of the Mass itself. So it has really, it's not yet the body of Jesus at the time. In any case, both of these charges, which, you know, we might laugh at or think are rather ridiculous, resulted amongst German Jews and Jews in other places in the murder of Jews, in the arrest and then extortion of Jews in order to be freed, in the torture of Jews and the beating of Jews over the centuries. I might make note that blood libels occurred in America in the early 20th century. There was a famous blood libel in Georgia. In Russia, the Mendel Baylis trial in the early 1900s. It's a theme that will be used by the Nazis as well, adapted for their purposes of the Jewish desire for blood. But it's only in the post-First Crusade period that these charges develop and become more popular. It's also in this first post-Crusader period that Jews begin to be expelled from German cities. The Black Death, which hits Europe in 1348, and according to historians, causes the death of up to a third of the population of Europe. It was absolutely devastating. 1348. The Black Death also results in attacks against the Jews. Now, we know that from primary sources that we have, Jews died from the Black Death too. But for some reason, the Jews were blamed for the Black Death, and they were blamed for poisoning the wells. And we know now that it was carried by rats, that it was a form of bubonic plague. But the Jews were accused of poisoning the wells. And for this, again, Jews were murdered, Jews were arrested, extorted, beaten and tortured, and in some cases expelled from cities. Some historians maintain that perhaps the Jews were accused because they suffered less from the plague. Perhaps they had more sanitary conditions. We don't know that. We don't know that. We do know that Jews died from the plague as well. For whatever reason, this was, in fact, the first instance, I think, of the international Jewish conspiracy. The charge of an international Jewish conspiracy to murder Christendom. It is not surprising that as a result of all of this persecution, many of the Jews living in Germanic lands are going to be moving during these centuries eastward to Poland. 1300s, 1400s, 1500s, we have a large-scale Jewish immigration from the lands of Ashkenaz, Germany, into Poland. And that's why most Ashkenazic Jews today can trace their roots probably to Poland or Russia or somewhere in Eastern Europe rather than necessarily to Germany.
How is Poland different from Germany?
Poland, we can't get into the details now, but the Polish kings invited the Jews. There were greater economic opportunities and there was greater toleration of the Jews during this time period in Poland, in part because of the protection of the kings. Those invitations were given in 1260-something, I think 1264 and I think 1344, I'm sorry, I don't have the dates with me, by two Polish kings. The second one was Casimir the Great, the first one was Bolesław the Pious. I don't know whether they were in relation to expulsions. There was also a general German migration eastward that Jews were a part of. Just as Jews were part of the migration from Europe to North America in the late 1800s and early 1900s, 2 million East European Jews made their way to North America, but they were part of a much larger migration of tens of millions of Italians and Greeks and Poles and many others. The same was true here. The Jews were also part of a larger migration. So it's not only a Jewish migration that's taking place. They're part of a larger general migration too. I'm making brief mention, because we don't have too much time, that Rashi had daughters. We'll talk about his daughters when we get to the Rashi house. His daughters married, and at least three of them had children. They produced some of the most important rabbinic figures who follow two generations after Rashi, including the Rashbam, and including some of the Baalei HaTosafot. I'll make mention of Yalkut Shimoni, which is published around 1150 by Rabbi Shimon HaDarshan. I'll mention the Or Zarua, halachic work, very important halachic work, done by Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna around 1250, who's generally known in halachic literature by his work, the Or Zarua. These are not all of Rashi's descendants. I'm now moving on beyond Rashi's descendants just to mention some of the important medieval works by leading rabbinic scholars. Thank you for that correction, Kara. Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, who wrote many, many responsa, who died in 1293. All of these are some of the leading German Jewish rabbinic figures during the medieval period. The Maharil, the Shnei Luchot Habrit from Frankfurt, who died in 1626. Basically, the status of the Jews begins to change. First of all, it does not significantly change due to the Reformation. The Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther, close to 1500, does not bring a change in the status of the Jews. Martin Luther tried to court the Jews, get them to convert to his religion. It didn't work. He is very angry at them for not following him. He writes vituperously about the Jews. He urges the princes to burn the synagogues, to expel the Jews. Martin Luther is a very important figure in German nationalism, in German history. His birthday is a day of celebration, or was a day of celebration. I'm not sure how many Germans celebrate it today. And you can't underestimate, one shouldn't underestimate, the influence Martin Luther has on German, not only German theology, but German political thought as well. And he was really a very, very, very strongly anti-Semitic in his writings. The status of the Jews does begin to change in the 1600s. When we begin to see the rise of absolutist and enlightened absolutist states, remember, Germany is not one country until 1871. And even when it becomes one country in 1871, culturally, Germany is more than its borders. Austria, for example, the Austrian Empire is essentially German. It's German in language. It's German in culture. Prague, Czechoslovakia, Bohemia, Moravia, those areas are also heavily influenced by Germany. So when we say Germany, we're not necessarily discussing one political entity. We're talking more about, if you like, Central Europe. And the various absolutist states become more common in the 1600s, and the rulers of these kingdoms, who see the interest of the state as supreme, begin to realize that the Jews are a very valuable asset, and expelling them is a waste. So states like Prussia, cities like Hamburg and Brandenburg and Pomerania, to name just a few, welcome the Jews to their territories, albeit with strings. Jewish life was highly regulated, mostly so that the state could extract as much wealth as it could from them. Laws were issued that addressed employment and restrictions on employment, family life, residency. Jews were living in ghettos during this time period. And the expulsions that were so common in the medieval period become much more rare in the early modern period, again, beginning in the 1600s. Questions up to this point? Okay, so in our next session, we are going to be doing, we're going to be talking about Moses Mendelssohn, the Haskalah, the beginning of modernity for German Jewry. David, you had a question?
Just a simple question. Throughout the period of time that we just learned about, were they speaking Yiddish?
Ah, I'm very glad you asked. David asks, were they speaking Yiddish? And the answer is yes. The answer is that Yiddish is essentially medieval German, with Hebrew elements. In fact, when Yiddish is written, it's written with Hebrew characters. And Yiddish becomes the lingua franca of German Jews, and of course, by extension, then, of East European Jews. We'll see in the modern period, it no longer is the lingua franca of German Jews, while it remains the lingua franca, ironically, of East European Jews. One of the things that Yiddish is a testimony to is the isolation of Jewish life. You know, the Jews have this medieval German, and it does not keep up to date with the German language as it develops. And in a sense, it's a sign of that isolation. But of course, they're mixed in with Hebrew elements, certainly, and also Slavic elements as the Jews move to Eastern Europe as well. The nature of Yiddish is such that it sort of embraces other languages. I remember one time I was sitting in my in-law's home, and there were visitors from Buenos Aires, and they were speaking Yiddish, and I understand Yiddish. And there were so many words I didn't understand that I felt very ignorant, and then I looked at my father-in-law and mother-in-law. I saw they were puzzled too, because they were Spanish words that they had incorporated into their Yiddish. And I remember they and my parents as well, who were Yiddish-speaking, would often, you know, speak what we call Hebrewish, but for them it was Yiddish, because they would often use English. Die kennst effen de window? Can you open the window? Right, there's a Yiddish word, Fenster. You know, it's not like there isn't a Yiddish word, but the mixing of the languages is something that happens very, very naturally in Yiddish. I know it happens in all languages, but certainly it happens in Yiddish. Certainly it did happen in Yiddish to a great extent.
And what was the lingua franca before Yiddish?
That's a very good question. What was the lingua franca of Jews living in Germany before Yiddish? And I don't know the answer to that. No longer Aramaic. That we can be certain. But it's a good question. I don't know the answer.
Also,
yes,
what, about what point in time did Yiddish become the lingua franca?
It's a good question. I have not found a date for that. When does Yiddish become the lingua franca of Ashkenazic Jews? But I would say that it's sometime in the medieval period. It's before the early modern period. Okay. Yes, Ben, last question.
Was there an Eastern European and Russian Jewish community before the migration?
Thank you for asking that question. No. There is no Jewish community in Russia. Jews are not allowed to come into Russia until the 1700s, at least under the Tsarist regime, meaning from the time of the Tsars around the year 1000, they keep the Jews out. They'll only be admitted when Russia conquers parts of Poland that have large numbers of Jews, and even then, in the late 1700s, they will restrict them to what they call the Pale of Settlement, and say, you can't come into Mother Russia. You can only be in these border areas. As for Poland, yes, there were Polish Jews from about the year, from probably before the year 1000, probably the 900s, the 10th century, we have evidence of Polish Jews. Some of them may have come from Germany. Others may have come from Turkey and other areas. But the largest number of Polish Jews actually come from this German migration, German-Jewish migration eastward, that begins to be large in the 1200s, 1300s, 1400s. And it's not only because of expulsions. It's because, as we said, of economic opportunities, it's because of other persecutions. I want to say one more word than about expulsions, and that is that expulsions in the medieval period were often very short-lived and not thoroughgoing. So, for example, from France, there are repeated expulsions of the Jews from France, and there's no document the Jews were invited back in between those expulsions. So exactly what's going on here? So I think that most historians feel that expulsions sometimes were more on paper than in reality, and sometimes it meant the Jews just had to cross the river over to the next town, and then they would be coming back in a short period afterwards. Nothing was like, most of these expulsions were not like the Spanish expulsion of the Jews in 1492, which was a thoroughgoing expulsion where Jews had to convert or die, and the Jews leave Spain and are not allowed back. That was unusual. Okay, the English expulsion was similar. The Jews were expelled from England, and they weren't allowed back for a number of centuries. But most of these expulsions in the Franco-German areas were probably not as thoroughgoing and not as permanent. Okay? Like? B'nai Korach, they're invited back. I think in many cases, even before a generation had passed. Thank you very much, and we'll meet again in order to discuss the beginnings of modernity amongst German Jews. Thank you.